So in a sense, I mean, you keep on, these situations happen. You fulfill a role of, as you've said to me before, as a kind of a gadfly. So you have to assume that at some point somebody's going to try and swat you now and again. So, and that plainly is what happens. Is there something in your background that leads you to have this kind of a resilient character? I read somewhere, for example, that the reason that you are such an avid enthusiast for marathons and so on, and running and so on, it says, despite a serious illness in his teens, I didn't know about that. What was that about?
I have presumably a genetic problem, common genetic problem with response to aspirin.
Oh.
So I get, or did get, enormous acid secretion if I took aspirin. There are very effective ways of dealing with that now, drugs, proton pump inhibitors and Tagamet and so on. I didn't benefit from those because they hadn't been developed at the time. But I remember in my teens, from the age of about 11 or 12 onwards, I had really quite growing symptoms of ulceration, yeah. Peptic ulceration. So lots of pain and so on, and then bleeding. Had a number of pretty serious bleeds actually through my teens, not realizing that this was connected with occasional use of aspirin. When I got a cold or something, my mum gave me Beecham's powders, which of course is heavily laced with aspirin, or I had aspirin when I had a headache or something. Of course, we all did. And what this did was to precipitate acid irritation. So, yeah, I was in hospital. I remember being in hospital for long periods of time after pretty serious bleeds in my teens, and finally had surgery, had a gastrectomy, had most of my stomach removed when I was an undergraduate at Cambridge, in my second year as a medical student at Cambridge. So it's a pretty severe setback. That's a surgical procedure which is almost unheard of these days because of these brilliant drugs that can control acid secretion. But there you are. I think Tagamet came onto the market 2 years after my gastrectomy. But that did, that raised my interest in medicine and how it worked, the medical profession, and how it worked. I had a lot of experience and contact with the medical profession. And my, to some extent, knowledge of the whole process of sort of drug development and which is based on fundamental science, that was sort of interesting experience. But also made me a bit concerned about health. There I was at the age of 20 or something, having undergone a pretty major procedure, thinking, well, is this it? I mean, is that the kind of, am I going to be an invalid for the rest of my life? So I did make a pretty obvious and deliberate commitment to trying to keep fit.
End up as CEO of the Medical Research Council. That's rather interesting. And obviously a lot of running in here. Sholto Burns' remark here, which is, I think, is supposed to be in a friendly. He bustles into his office, rangy limbs sticking like beanpoles out of his trousers. A keen marathon runner, he has the physique to show for it. So you obviously still run, I assume. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So.
I run most, well, not every day, but as much as I can.
He did not come from an academic family. His father was a radio operator during Second World War, television salesman afterwards, and so on. So, simple, what we would call working class background in England, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, my dad joined up in the Air Force very young. I mean, just left school at 16. I mean, I think no one had, or even earlier than 16. I mean, no one in my family had gone to school after the age beyond the age of 15 or 16 ever. But there's no way of judging the potential of people by what happened to them in those days. I mean, one of the really revolutionary changes is that people have more opportunity, at least, to live up to their talents. So who knows what the real level of potential of my father and my mother and so on was. I mean, my mother's still alive and is a very sharp person, very bright person. But again, left school, I think, at 15. So what chance do you have? So I was the first. But like, many people in my generation, many, many people in the baby boom, post-war years, post-Attlee Labour government, welfare state and all of this, opportunities for everyone. you know, many people became the first people in their family to go to university, and that was my position.
So emerging through a meritocracy process, so
yes, exactly.
11 plus exams and so on.
11 plus, yes.
You presumably got a scholarship of some kind?
My parents never paid a penny. My parents, I mean, we lived in a very poor area of Coventry, which had been virtually destroyed in the Second World War from bombing. I was born in Stratford, which is very kind of romantic, and people often mention that. Yes, exactly. I was only there for a day because there were no maternity hospitals left in Coventry because they had been destroyed in the war. So my mother was evacuated for my birth, but still it's on my passport. So we lived in a very poor area initially. My parents did very well, and we moved to better and better houses through my life. But my early experience was from a very, very poor area of the city, and I went to a simple primary school where no one, I think, had ever gone to the local grammar school, which was the only potential route to getting into university. And my parents, you know, bless their souls, although they didn't really have the wherewithal to do it, paid for me to go for a couple of years to the primary section of the local grammar school, the primary school section of the local grammar school, because the local primary school said, you know, we think, you know, your son maybe has the potential to be able to go to grammar school, but no one's ever gone to grammar school from this school. Is there anything you can do about it? So they pulled together their money. My mother told me that she sold an insurance policy to pay for the school fees for the final year that I was in the primary school. And I took the 11 plus, got a scholarship. They never had to pay a penny for my education from then on. Right through grammar school, Cambridge, medical student and everything. Not a penny. It was all covered by scholarships.
You came to the UK, to the United States reasonably early. You went to Berkeley at one point, didn't you?
Well, I did. Actually, I came to the States between school and university. That was my first experience. I bummed around the States. I remember begging my dad to loan me a bit of money, and he gave me £100, an enormous amount of money then, actually. £100 to set out on this sort of 3 or 4 month trip. And I came back and gave him £160 in return.
How did you make the profit?
Well, I worked.
Oh, okay.
I worked all over, you know. Well, doing anything, delivering cars, cleaning windows, working in a hotel, a fantastic job at an international jazz festival in Washington, D.C., which was, you know, they called it work. I had to go to the dressing rooms of all the performers, the greatest jazz artists in the world at that time, because they were all there. Thelonious Monk, I don't know, so on, and say, you know, you're on now, Mr. Monk, lead them up on stage, sit on the stage, listen to performance, take them back and get the next people. They called that a job and they paid me to do it. It was fantastic. But then I came to Berkeley after I finished my undergraduate degree in Cambridge, came to Berkeley to do a PhD.
And so why did you get the Wayne Fleet professorship at such a young age? Any idea? Well, was the work cutting edge at that point?
There are lots of answers to that question. One is that the person that they first offered it to in the end turned them down. I know that. So I was very much no second or perhaps nth choice in the process. But I got a phone call. I didn't apply for the job. Sitting in my cupboard of an office in Cambridge, and got a phone call from one of the electors to the chair saying, you know, do you know about this position? If you were offered it, would you take it?
So never any thought about any other kind of career. You obviously sounds as though you love music by the sounds of it there, but I mean, science was always the... You saw the
no, it
the
wasn't
escalator.
Actually. The great... The British system has this harsh set of choice points. You know, we specialise very early, and it's not 11 plus anymore, at least not in most of the country. We don't kind of divide children at this ridiculous age of 11 between those that we think are competent, you know, to perform and those that are out of the academic system forever. But there are some serious choice points, and it partly comes from I think, over-specialisation at an early age. So there's a dilemma of choosing what subjects to do for A level, advanced level, and it was a very difficult choice, actually. I was okay at science, but I was also equally okay at languages and arts and things. And And I did a lot of painting. I developed a great interest in painting, spent all my spare time painting. And I did A-level art, actually, as well as sciences in the end, and seriously thought about going in the arts direction. But my best friend decided he was going to go into arts and did languages, and I thought, though, it's just to be, you know, to be different, I'd do science. So that was really one of the reasons why I chose science rather than art.
Oh, so but why wouldn't you go with the best friend in that?
Oh, well, you know, not wanting to appear to do exactly the same, and you know.
You've been married for a very long time to Andre, who you met at 15? In some sources?
Yeah, I think it's probably 15 or 16. I remember. Yes, I remember going to her 16th birthday party.
This was in Coventry somewhere? Were we still in the area?
It was in Coventry, yes. So she lived in Coventry. We went to the local girls' grammar school, segregated, of course, at that stage. So I went to the boys' grammar school, she went to the girls' grammar school. And she's the sister of someone who was in the class above me in the grammar school. So.
And you've had three daughters, mm-hmm. one of whom, Sarah Jane, as we know, is a neuroscientist of some repute now.
A very considerable repute. I'm proud of her, yeah. Well, I'm proud of all of them. Let me qualify that.
Yes, I was happening to mention one because I was in contact with her recently, as you know, so that's what came to mind. Let me ask you about this, shifting back now to the whole notion of the relationship between scientists and politicians, scientists and government. This is from the Times, British Times, online. Headline is, "Government attempt to repair relations with scientists risk backfiring." After the dismissal of Professor David Nutt as the chief drugs advisor. This seems to be a fairly volatile issue in the UK at the moment, and it has ramifications which I think one could reasonably extend to other governments, other countries. And as a consequence of this, we ended up with your having written something called Principles for the Treatment of Independent Expert Advice. Would you like to context that for me?
Yeah. Yes, okay. So, the first thing I should say is that I didn't write the document alone. It is the result of a very extensive consultation in the scientific community, particularly amongst the large number of academic scientists who give their time, considerable time, without pay or with absolutely minimum expenses and so on, to participate in scientific advisory committees for the government, and also consultation with the Royal Society and with leading figures in the scientific community to draw up a statement of what we considered was the government's stated relationship with their scientific advisors. I spoke in very positive terms about the British government's commitment to the use of advice and evidence as the basis of policy. But we just went through something of a wobble, if you like, in the certainty of that commitment with this episode of the sacking of the chair of an advisory council, a very important advisory council, the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, which is an advisory committee consisting of some 30 people, not all scientists, I mean all experts in different areas, including the police, the law, psychiatry, social services, and so on, and lay representation. And it's a statutory committee, that is, it's set up in law, in the 1971 Misuse of Drugs Act. The ACMD, Advisory Council on Misuse of Drugs, is charged with providing the best possible advice to government about the relative harms of drugs, including drugs that are on the streets but are not yet illegal, in other words, recommending whether they ought to be illegal. And that should then be used as the basis of policy by government.
May I interject something at this point? Because my memory is that there's a fairly long history here of your having made statements about the relative dangers and harms of different kinds of drugs. I remember that you were very vocal in complaining about a publication of a paper about the damaging effects of ecstasy, MDMA, in the journal Science, which in fact later turned out to be bogus, as I recall. And that you have often made comments about the use of what would be called recreational drugs as being possibly less harmful than the use of alcohol and tobacco and so on. So is that roughly correct?
Yes. I mean, it's a long-standing interest, but not just a kind of, I think everybody should be interested and concerned about drugs of potential abuse. But it's also an academic interest. I published a paper in The Lancet a couple of years ago on possible rigorous methodology for ranking the harms of drugs. Not an easy thing to do. You know, is cocaine more harmful than amphetamines? Well, you know, who says, and how do you assess that? So this was suggesting a way of doing that rigorously and consistently in a way that, based on expertise, and a way that could be updated regularly, so as to provide, you know, government with that crucial information. And that that paper in Lancet, I mean, caused a great deal of interest. It was recommended by the House of Commons Select Committee on Science and Technology. It was quoted in very positive terms by the government, the Department of Science's review of brain sciences and addiction, a big horizon-scanning review. It was commended in a report from the Academy of Medical Sciences and another one from the Royal Society of Arts. So it had a big influence. And that paper, by the way, the first author on the paper was David Nutt, Professor David Nutt, who was a former student of mine in Cambridge. I know him. Have worked with him, and he was, until very recently, chairman of the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. Now, so there's the connection.
And what is it said that he, how did he transgress, according to the government, which resulted in his firing?
Well, I have to say that's never been, you know, fully explained. But it was said that trust and confidence had broken down between him and the Home Secretary, Alan Johnson, but not just one Home Secretary, two Home Secretaries. Jackie Smith, the previous Home Secretary, I think was less than happy with the ACMD in general, but David Nutt in particular. And the problem was that he was critical of the government not having accepted the advice of the ACMD, specifically in relation to the classification, just the classification of harm level of cannabis and then ecstasy. The law in the UK has a system, a very simple system for classifying drugs on the basis of their perceived harm, and that's how it's stated, without specifying very clearly what that means. With drugs being classified as A, B, or C. A being the most harmful, B and then C. And it is in the law the job of the ACMD to recommend, on the basis of the review of all the evidence, to recommend what level any drug should be at. And also, as I said, to recommend whether drugs that are not illegal should be brought into that system and be made illegal. At present, Class A drugs, for which the maximum sentence for possession is 14 years in prison, I think that's correct, include heroin, crack cocaine, methadone, LSD, and ecstasy. In the study of relative harms, based on the classification of drugs, a whole range of drugs, with a quantitative estimate of the harm for 9 different ways in which drugs might harm people and society, ecstasy was bottom of the list in terms of the harm index of all illegal drugs. LSD was very near the bottom. So, you know, it just struck us as there's an anomaly there. A full and rigorous assessment of all the ways in which drugs can harm people and put these two Class A drugs right at the bottom, far below tobacco and alcohol, which we also included in the analysis on exactly the same terms. We simply pointed, this isn't an opinion, it's the result of an analysis. The analysis might be flawed, but it wasn't just a throwaway opinion. The ACMD came to very similar views when they reviewed the ranking of cannabis and ecstasy.
And the ACMD, again, just to spell those initials.
The Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, of which Dave Nutt is now, or was then, the chairman. So over the past 2 years, there have been two substantial recommendations from the ACMD about changes in the classification of drugs. The first was that cannabis should remain a Class C drug. In 2004, I think it was, David Blunkett, who was then the Home Secretary, asked for a report from the ACMD on the classification of cannabis, which was then classed as B.
So that'd be middle.
The middle ranking. In middle harm, yeah. And asked for it, I think, partly on the basis of concerns from many ordinary people that their children, whom they knew to be smoking the odd joint on weekends, might be discovered and might get a criminal record, a serious criminal record, as a Class B drug user, very significant. And a concern that this wasn't really a reflection on whether they were criminals or not, and actually wasn't an accurate representation of the real risk of doing that. And I have to say, it's very difficult to judge, to talk in neutral terms about such an emotional subject as the use of illegal drugs. I mean, it's an issue that raises huge concerns, quite rightly, and great passions and very firm convictions, whether those convictions are based on, fact and evidence or not. So, I mean, it's always important to preface any discussion by saying that, no drug is safe. And ecstasy is a dangerous drug. But the fact is, some drugs have got to be more dangerous than others, and we just have to recognise that. So David Blunkett had said, let's review the evidence and see whether really it does justify the classification of cannabis as B. The ACMD reviewed it 5 years ago, whatever it is, and said, no, we think it's a Class C drug. It was downgraded to C. Which upset, I think, a lot of people who had a firm conviction about any drug. And the whole notion of saying that a drug was less harmful was thought to be unacceptable to some parts of the media and to some politicians. So there was a lot of objection to that. And subsequently, 2 years ago, the government asked for a new review of cannabis and in a way almost instructed the ACMD to change their mind. I mean, that's very much the terms of reference for the review that was undertaken 3 years ago by the ACMD. And the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary made it pretty clear in public statements that they were going to reclassify cannabis, whatever the ACMD said. And that was, undermined, really, the authority of the ACMD and upset a lot of members of it at the time. Nevertheless, they went through the whole process, reviewed all the scientific literature, 30 of them with a whole wide range of expertise. And their considered judgment was, it was a clear majority view, not all of them signed up, but a very clear majority view was that it should remain as a Class C drug. They also pointed out that the use of cannabis in the UK had been in steady and significant decline since 2000, with no evidence that the reclassification, the downgrading, had had any influence on that decline. If anything, it had accelerated a bit. So no influence at the classification level influenced the behaviour of young people. And I think that's pretty clear. And there are perhaps 250,000 regular ecstasy users in the UK. Ecstasy is a Class A drug, 14 years in prison. So, classification is not, actually affecting behaviour very much, as far as we can tell. So they said, it's been in decline. We don't think the evidence is clear that risk has increased. We think it should be Class C. The government immediately rejected the advice, had already done so, and they've reclassified it to B, which sort of shook the foundations of the advisory process. So the ACMD then said, we're going to undertake a review of ecstasy. And it was partly in light of the work that David Nutt and I think had done and the interest around that, which showed ecstasy very low in harm compared with other drugs. Let me reclassify that. It's not a harmless drug. So they reviewed all of the evidence, and their conclusion was ecstasy should not be a Class A drug, and we suggest it's a Class B. which was rejected again before it was produced. Now, David actually had been chair of the research subcommittee, which had undertaken the literature review on ecstasy, so was very knowledgeable about the literature. David was, I think, president of the British Psychopharmacological Society at the time, and also is the chief editor of one or other journals in this I mean, he's a very eminent psychopharmacologist and psychiatrist. He is the incoming president of the European Society for Pharmacology or something like psychopharmacology. I mean, a very eminent scientist. He wrote a paper on risk analysis. And his point was, we misperceive, very well-known point, he wasn't the first person to say it, that people are actually very bad at judging risk on the basis of evidence. You know, people don't understand what probabilities really mean. And their gut reactions to situations often determine their perception of risk. So people have this sort of view that somehow, you know, flying on aeroplanes is much more dangerous than walking down the street or driving a car, because statistics show exactly the opposite. So he highlighted that, and this is probably a mistake of judgment on his part, by comparing the risk of using ecstasy and the risk of horse riding. And it was a bit tongue-in-cheek. He said, you know, he had discovered this little known disease called equisy.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. And he analysed seriously, using serious evidence, morbidity, mortality, patterns, drug usage, age, profiles, and everything. And the result was very clear that actually it's more risky to ride a horse recreationally for the weekends, you know, than to take ecstasy and go raving. And that did not endear him. And this was released. This was actually leaked to a sort of European anti-drug organisation, a lot of publicity, just before the report of the ACMD was published. This was a peer-reviewed paper in an international journal. Peer-reviewed scientific publication. His name was Professor David Nutt, Department of Psychiatry, University of Bristol, which he's now at Imperial College. No mention of his membership of the ACMD. He wasn't chair of the ACMD then. He was a member of it. So, you know, academic freedom of all that. He was publishing peer-reviewed paper. But he was taken to task for it. The Home Secretary telephoned him in the middle of his psychiatry outpatient clinic on a Friday afternoon and said that she demanded an apology to the parents of all children who had died as a result of ecstasy overdose. Not many of them, but she wanted fewer than parents of children who'd been killed on horses, according to his evidence. But nevertheless, Home Secretary, pretty intimidating interaction between government and an advisor. So David, being the character that he is, was pretty public in his criticism of that, and of the government's handling of the recommendations of the ACMD and the way in which the results were dismissed before they were published and so on. Now, I don't want to, you know, I want to give a personal opinion of what I feel about the justice of the dismissal of David Nutt. He was fired in an email message from the Home Secretary for giving an invited lecture at King's College, a named lecture, King's College, London, which was billed not in his name as chairman of the ACMD, but as an academic member of Imperial College, where apparently he had sought the advice of the chief scientist of the Home Office about whether he was entitled to give this lecture, and approval was given, where the staff of the ACMD had actually helped him to prepare the PowerPoint presentation and so on. But nevertheless, after the lecture, which was about the whole history of the drug, this recent history of drug policy and advice and how it was gathered, and the fact that it had been rejected by government, he gave media interviews and was critical of government, no doubt about that. This riled the Home Secretary, and the Home Secretary wrote him an email message saying, I've lost confidence in you and I would like you to resign. Subsequent to the resignation, he made even more critical remarks, even of the Prime Minister and so on. So he burnt his bridges, I think. But, this produced something of a crisis, I think, for this relationship, this strong relationship which had been constructed over the last 10 years between government and advisers on the basis of this past history of BSE and so on, where there was a very clear, you know, statutory set of guidelines and so on about the independence of advisers, their freedom to speak and communicate to the public, even their right to have their own press officer and communicate directly without even informing the government. This is all written into government regulations. So there was some concern, I think, in the community, particularly amongst people on advisory committees, about what the implications might be for the academic freedom of scientists who gave their time in serving the government. So the interesting debate that this precipitated, I think, it's been a very civilized interaction over the last few weeks. I hope we'll have a very positive outcome in reaffirming the government's commitment to the process, and in fact just reinforcing those elements of it which might prevent a similar incident occurring in the future.
Interestingly enough, one wonders whether it's the subject matter
of this. Of course.
Yes, right. So, yeah. and
would it have happened about food safety, I suspect?
Well, I was going to say that a conversation I had with Doug Melton recently about stem cells, he was basically making the point, and it's on the Science Network, of course, he was basically making the point that he thought that the British way of having dealt, the UK way of having dealt with the whole stem cell issue was a model, and that the way it was being dealt with, had been dealt with in the US, was just a disgrace. Mm-hmm. So plainly it's not just a scientific issue here. I mean, and the stem cell model in UK obviously is highly regarded. I mean,
yes, it's true. But of course, you know, politics is threaded through all of this. And one has to say that the admirable way in which the embryo research and stem cell debate has been handled in the UK would have been impossible without a degree of political facilitation to begin with. Because what was admirable about it was the extent of the discussion and the debate that happened at every level, in the media, in subcommittee groups, in public meetings, in high-level committees established by the government to review embryo research and so on. Now, I think that could not have happened without the government, in a sense, giving its nod to the process. It's not to say that it made its mind up in advance, but it probably could have stopped the degree and the extent of the debate, which has underpinned the UK's pretty much consensual commitment to a liberal policy on stem cell research.
Yeah. Now, this again brings in this whole notion that we've touched on several times already about moral postures. Obviously, we're talking about drugs here. We're talking about stem cells in UK, and the debate in the United States, obviously, about stem cells was very much intertwined with religion, which in the UK would not be.
Very little. I mean, that was an issue. You know, there's an outburst from one or two Catholic bishops, not most actually, at a crucial stage in the argument about the new Fertilisation and Embryology Act, which has, you know, some very apparently very radical elements to it. It looks very surprising, I think, to the outside world. This new legislation, which has just passed a year or so ago through both houses of parliament with large majorities on a free vote, contains the right to create embryos which are half human, half animal in their content, either by direct fertilization or by cloning, putting a human nucleus into an empty animal egg, and also includes things like reaffirming the commitment to late-stage abortion, to recognizing the potential that embryos, and therefore babies, might be derived from more than two individuals by genetic reassembly, artificial genetic reassembly, by accepting the notion of embryo selection, including saviour siblings, the notion that parents should be allowed to choose an embryo on the basis of its potential to provide blood or even tissue for an existing sibling who has a disease that might be treated, say, by bone marrow transplantation.
The spare part.
Yeah, spare part babies. Even allowing birth certificates not to mention a male to list two women as the registered parents of a child. I mean, these are extraordinary issues, each of them. Probably shocking to many Americans. They're all there in a single piece of legislation that sailed through through Parliament. And the reason it sailed through was because it was reinforced by 20 years of really serious and involved debate and discussion at every level of society. So that, I mean, it is, as Doug Melton said, an example of how well things can work in the UK.
On the other hand, those things that you've just enumerated, don't they give you pause?
Of course they should give pause. But pause is just an opportunity to think, isn't it? I mean, what is pause? It's a chance to reflect and therefore not to make knee-jerk judgments. And each of those things might well have precipitated, you know, in me when I first heard them, a knee-jerk judgment. Yuck, that must be wrong. And yuck is a good starting point for a moral debate. Reasonably, you know, starting position, but not necessarily the one you might end up at.
So, what's your sense then of the similarities and the differences between UK and US at this point in terms of relationship between society and public and government and both sides of the pond? Large question, I admit.
Well, I hope we're not sort of moving in opposite directions, just passing each other like, you know, strangers in the night, with the US rebuilding the relationship between scientists and government, between advice and policy, and the UK perhaps going on a downward slope. I mean, that would be very unfortunate. I think the UK has set high standards for how this can work, and I very much would applaud the government for what it's achieved in that area, and successive chief scientific advisors, Bob May, Dave King, and John Beddington now. And with some, you know, some wobbles and some perturbations, I think we will stay on track in that respect. And I hope that the US will re-establish not its place as a scientific nation, that's indubitable for the time being. Who knows what the future holds, but, you know, its standing in science is unchallenged. But nevertheless, despite the fact that it is the greatest scientific nation on Earth, that it leads in almost every scientific field, there is not yet a comfortable relationship between science and the American public, in my view. It is a very difficult one. It's partly because of, you know, the fact that this is a much more religious country and committee country than the UK. It is because of the unfamiliarity with the scientific method. It is to do with a lack of openness in science and a lower level of development of engagement, communication, and engagement by scientists with the public, something that, you know, the UK again has done brilliantly in the last few years. So I think there's a long way to go. You're helping, but there's a long way to go. It'd be good if you did. It'd be lovely to see the United States fulfilling Obama's promise to put science back into its rightful place at the heart of the way in which the country is run.
This is the 350th anniversary year, as you know, of the foundation of the Royal Society. This is a refrain Science Network viewers are used to hearing me say recently, because in tying that to the rightful place, what is the rightful place? I'm looking back at this 350 years of the longest running uninterrupted science business on the planet. And thinking back to Francis Bacon as well, and thinking back to his novel The New Atlantis, where he had the Merchants of Light. And let me jump to a comment made by Sir Peter Medawar, who you probably would have known.
Yes.
Where Medawar had been accused at one point of writing an essay in favour of Bacon's New Atlantis and sounding like it was utopian. In other words, as though science was being given too much of a writ to do whatever it felt like doing. Rather like that. People must have first heard that bill that you're talking about now with spare parts children and so on and so forth. And Medawar wrote back and said, no, I'm in fact a scientific meliorist. I believe in using the scientific method to make things better. Is that pretty much your position, you think?
Absolutely. You have to recognise that there are many other considerations that impinge on decisions about whether to take advice. A scientist might provide and should provide their best analysis of the available evidence on risk, let's say, and therefore their advice about what to do. But their advice may be unacceptable for many reasons, good reasons. It might be beyond the potential of the economy to implement what scientists are recommending. You just can't afford it. It might be politically unacceptable for the government. They're elected. They have a particular line on issues. They might say, "Well, thanks for that advice, but we just can't accept that. It doesn't fit with our political philosophy." It might be that they think the public opinion wouldn't accept it, or I suppose they might not explicitly argue this, but it's true. They might not think the media would like it, and they get bad press. So there can be many, or it might infringe existing laws or international treaties or whatever. There can be all sorts of reasons why the politicians can quite legitimately overrule advice. But they should have that advice. They should have access to the best possible available analysis of evidence. And as Medua says, the intention is to try to make things better by making judgments based on fact rather than just fantasy or speculation or political whim.
I'm thinking now about this book I have here, Mechanics of the Mind, which you will recognize.
Just about recognize.
Yeah. Which you recognize. A television series that you did for the BBC, I suppose it must have been, right? And you've done...
Mechanics of the Mind? No, you're confusing it with another book.
Oh, that
Mechanics
was the
Mind
of
was
lectures.
The Reith Lectures. Was based on the Reith Lectures, 1976, which is a series of radio lectures.
Then there was a book which had a similar title, which was about a television
the
series.
The Mind Machine.
The Mind Machine, yep. There we are. So in other words, great deal of lecturing, great deal of public communication, lots of television stuff, some on the Vega Science Channel of Harry Kroto's as well, conversations and so on. So you've thought a lot about communication of science, you do it a lot, are you still president of the British Association of...
Science. The Association of British Science Writers,
right.
ABSW, yeah.
Right.
And I've been president of the BA, the British Association,
British Association of Science. So let me just make a quick reference to this little book, which is by Cornelia Dean, mm-hmm. New York Times. Corey Dean, Am I Making Myself Clear? A Scientist's Guide to Talking to the Public. Mm. Where she makes the point that, and she cites somebody else's work here, she says that researchers view journalists as, one, insufficiently concerned with accuracy, superficial, sensationalist, focused on controversy and tension, ignorant, unethical and willing to do anything to get the story, and the journalists view researchers quite often as boring, hair-splitting, caveating things to death, overly intended and interested in process, unable to articulate a bottom line or distinguish the forest for the trees, and users of unintelligible jargon.
Mm-hmm.
Some truth in all of that.
Yeah, of course there is, yeah.
Because it's been done pretty well in UK, I think. How do you go about creating at least this more convivial relationship between the science community and the public via the science press?
Well, first of all, I would qualify that and say that although it's a recognisable caricature, it applies much, much more to the relationship between scientists and the news desk, news journalists, than it does to the relationship between scientists and science journalists, medical editors and so on. Where one hopes there is a high level of expertise in the journalists. They know the facts. They know how science works. They know the reason to qualify. They can cut through the jargon because they understand it. And in general, the standards of science and medical writing in the newspapers are pretty high, both in the UK and here, in my opinion. The big worry is when science hits the front page. When it is a BSE or a MMR vaccination and autism, or it's foot and mouth disease, or it's shock horror stories, animal research.
Global warming,
exactly. So when it hits the front page, the stories are written by different people with different, drivers, professional drivers. And what matters is the story and the line. And yes, a little bit of sensationalism around the edge sells the newspapers better, gets them more attention. So there is maybe more of a willingness to cut corners, just to oversimplify. And that, you know, contravenes all kinds of principles of thinking about science by scientists. You can't cut corners. There are qualifications. There are ambiguities. There are reasons to split hairs, and you need to say them. And it doesn't appeal to news desk writers. One of the things that people have given a lot of thought to in the UK is how to resolve that conundrum. Quality of science and medical writing in newspapers, and sometimes the process going seriously wrong on the front pages. One of the devices that's been established, which has helped a lot, is the establishment of the Science Media Centre in London. It's in the Royal Institution, although independent, effectively, of the Royal Institution, which is a focus for interaction between the scientific community and journalists. And I must say, it's done a brilliant job under the very able leadership of Fiona Fox, the director, building the confidences and the contacts and relationships between journalists and science. So things, don't go wrong as frequently now as they did in the past. And there's much more recognition of the issue by editors in general, and much more concern, I think, to get things right. So that's, I think, one approach. But the other thing which has really helped is this explosion of a new profession of science engagement, not just science communication, but science engagement in the UK. University degree courses, graduates, training courses, scientists themselves involved, the Royal Society, the Wellcome Trust, the MRC and so on, giving grants to help people to do it. And what is it that they're doing? They're trying to encourage interaction between scientists and representations of science and the public in exploring areas of misunderstanding and difficulty where ethics and the scientific process impinge particularly. And I really think we're leading the world in that area, and with some very positive outcomes.
Especially given the number of people the number of science reporting jobs that have been lost in the US recently, yes. Which is somewhat alarming.
Yes. Fewer, I think, in the UK lost. Because there is this... Science is sort of up the agenda for the UK press in ways that hasn't been in the past. And maybe it's a little bit on the back of the Science Media Centre, partly on the back of the very successful World Congress of Science Journalists last year in London, which has been left a very positive air. But the press is attentive to this issue. The Times, for instance, just launched a new monthly supplement on science, Eureka, a whole separate magazine that comes with the Times newspaper, committed entirely to science. That's a very positive sign.
So, is there any of the sense that if you're too public a figure, you're likely to get slapped down again? I mean, the famous story over here, of course, was Carl Sagan not being honoured as a. Now you're in a public position over there. Susan Greenfield just went through a little bit of a fracas at the Royal Institution, and so yeah. on.
Yes, I mean, it is odd. I would say it's not. It's still not entirely accepted by the scientific establishment that active researchers should soil their hands by interaction with the dirty media, despite things like the Reith Lectures, despite the Royal Society and all its programmes of support for these sorts of things. The Wellcome Trust do a brilliant job of actively encouraging scientists to be involved, and MRC as well. It is highly respectable at that sort of visible level for scientists to engage with the public. In fact, it's increasingly recognised as part of the responsibility of a scientist, of a researcher, of an academic to spend some of their time doing those kinds of things. Nevertheless, there's still the sniping and the rumours and the criticisms of the telly dons, as they're sometimes called, or people who, they're dabbling with the media because, they're not very good at science, so this is another way. All that kind of, or they're doing it for pots of money. Well, anyone who's done anything with the BBC knows they're not going to fill their pockets with money by working for them. But, it's still, it's the image of the scientist talking to the public is still not crystal clear in the UK. It gets better all the time.
Let me give you a case study, and as we roll to a close here, let me give you a case study. One of the, as you know, that we've been doing, building certain sections of the Science Network dealing with certain issues. So we have a lot of things on stem cells. We have issues on sleep and so on. We're building, with the help of the Glenn Foundation for Medical Research right now, a big part of the Agora on aging, actually on staying alive, diet, nutrition, metabolism, yes, and aging, which also involves sleep as well. It also goes across into education when you look at the way diet and sleep patterns influence schooling, children. And obviously, you know, I look at this, the current Time magazine,
yes, I've seen it.
The
I've
Science
seen it.
Of Living Longer. The aging cure here, can we cure aging? US News and World Report, the cover is, can we live to 100 and more at this point? That's on the newsstands at this point. This issue magazine called Good has a, can we live to 200 with an interview with Aubrey de Grey in there and so on. It's obviously on everybody's mind. The Economist a year ago did a thing called a slow burning fuse, however.
Yeah.
Which dealt with other implications, demographic implications.
Yeah, the downside.
Now, the reason I want to bring this to your attention is that, you know, here's a subject that's very much on people's minds, baby boom population and so on. The science is out there. But the engagement here between scientists and government and policymakers is something that you can speak to, because I know that you've been thinking about these issues in all of these areas. Mm. So could you give me some sense of where you think this, the science of living longer or its implications are going in terms of...
Yeah. I think it's an absolutely fascinating issue from both the policy point of view and the point of view of science, because it raises these huge dilemmas. The most obvious one being, you know, the very natural desire to live longer, you know, as long as one has a full and rich life. But on the other hand, the imponderable negative consequences of everyone living longer, especially if it's not a perfectly healthy life, all of the consequences of old age and the medical costs and these sorts of things. So there's that sort of tension, which is fascinating. My interest in this area recently has been stimulated by being on a panel, an advisory panel for an insurance company, a major insurance company, Legal & General. Who provide annuities and pensions and things like this. So really their job is to predict when people die. And they're suddenly a bit kind of nervous about this because the predictions are going seriously wrong. I mean, for 30 years now, the United Nations, every 10 years, has made a pronouncement about its expectations for the pattern of life expectancy, general pattern of life expectancy for the future. And those pronouncements have always been, well, it must flatten off at some point. Life expectancy has been rising on average, and actually very steadily, at the equivalent of about 7 or more hours per day of existence since 1840. The life expectancy in the UK at the turn of the last century, in 1900, was well under 40 years of age, and it's now actually one of the highest in the world. Higher than the US, interestingly, on average. 86 or something like that. And that increase in life expectancy has been explained by, caused by, a whole lot of different sorts of interventions. Public health intervention, better water, cleaner water, better sanitation, better food, access to food. Then, you know, vaccinations, treatment of infant diseases and all those things, and on and on and on. Better now, better treatments for heart disease, some improvements with cancer, and so the whole story. Interestingly, despite the fact that those contributions are very different from each other, the trend has been linear all the way through, of 7 or so hours a day, which is really very interesting. But the assumption has always been this can't go on forever. We're sort of running out of obvious ways in which the disease elements of life can be reduced or eliminated. So in the end, we must hit the buffers of the inherent limit to human life. And many people would argue that's 120, because no one's lived, as far as Methuselah aside, has lived beyond about 120 years. So it does look, you know, there's something finite out there. But then other people say, well, just a minute, in principle, biologically, there need be no limit, especially if we kind of patch up the chromosomes and the bits that go, the fraying at the ends of the chromosomes or something, you know, why not? Why shouldn't it be possible to live much, much longer? I mean, some animals certainly appear not to age in the same way. I mean, they get knocked off by diseases or by predators or something. There are certain fish and reptiles and so on where there seems not to be a normal aging process. They replace themselves. They have a very good regenerative system.
Right.
There's evidence that, for instance, in fruit flies, if you look at the probability of a fruit fly dying, it's the same throughout life. Now, all fruit flies do die, but they die because of something that happens to them, not just because they get old. So, you know, is there really a limit to life expectancy? That's the big issue, which is beginning to worry hugely the insurance companies, as you can imagine.
Because they're predicated on the fact that we have a use-by date, right? So,
but, you know, there are two issues here. One is, you know, how long are we already going to live on the basis of what's been achieved now? And you mentioned that the speculations about the possibility of people living to 100... The majority of children born since 2000 will live to be more than 100. I mean, that seems very clear. A paper in The Lancet, I think maybe the BMJ just a few weeks ago, analysing, not on the basis of present mortality rates, which is the way that most of these projections are done, but looking at the whole pattern of the change of mortality, of the likelihood of dying, and making a very clear prediction that you know, most children will live to be more than 100. Well, that already is, you know, raises enormous problems, not least the problem of work span, retirement, pensions, all that kind of stuff. But also, unless we solve the problems of the degenerative diseases of older age, not the things that kind of kill you immediately, but the things that are incredibly costly to society and to healthcare, unless we solve those, we are in for the most incredible disaster in health costs. So we're well on the way to 100 anyway. But then the bigger question is, could we artificially manipulate human aging so as to exceed this 120-year limit? And there are some serious ideas out there which we have to take seriously and make a choice. Do we want to go that route? This is a very important ethical, moral judgment. There are too many people in the world already, you know, and we're heading for 9 billion or more pretty soon. And that is driving many of the problems that we face. Food supply and resources, energy demands, global warming. I mean, all of these things, pandemic infections. I mean, all of this stuff. So, you know, should we be doing things that actually make people live longer? I mean, I'm not giving an answer to that, but it's certainly something we should be thinking about just as deeply as we think about, you know, global warming or embryo research.
So, coupled with that is, I hate to keep brandishing covers at you, but it's interesting to me that at least these major magazines are actually having lots of science covers these days, which is a good sign.
It surprises you? Ooh. But I mean, in what area of life, I mean, everyday life, is science or should science not be an underpinning factor? You know, what you eat, how you work, whether you exercise, whether the environment is safe for you, where you get your energy from, what car you drive and why, how the transport systems you use, what sports you do, what education you have for your children. I mean, all of these areas of life have a scientific thread, or should have an evidence-based thread running through them.
Right, but it's
so it should be on the front page of every newspaper and every magazine.
Dichotomy, isn't it? Here I am on the one hand, in an earlier part of the conversation, bemoaning the fact that lots of publications are getting rid of their science journalists, talking about the difficulty that one senses in getting science out to a general audience, knowing from public engagements with people that when you actually talk to them, they're engrossed by it and really enjoy it, knowing that obviously Time magazine, as an economic principle, thinks that if it puts science on the cover, it can sell magazines.
Yeah, good evidence.
This is about epigenetics.
Yeah.
Why is there this apparent separation?
Well, I mean, don't ask me, you should ask the editors. Why are they firing science journalists and when they're putting it on the front cover? I mean,
I'm talking about a disjunction between. There must be some people somewhere who don't think science is very interesting to a large audience, right? But plainly, it is.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think that that disjunct lies with the people who own or manage the media. That they, you know, they don't actually value high-quality scientific journalism, even though they know that the images and so on sell newspapers and magazines. Well, what that might mean, of course, is that they see that science can deliver interesting stories, and they're not necessarily that concerned, or they don't think that it is necessary to have highly trained, professionally qualified writers who know about science in order to produce those kinds of stories. Just as, you know, you can write great stories about baseball matches without being able to play baseball yourself. Or even really understanding that much about the fine details of what it is to be a great baseball player. But, you know, for science, you do, I think, to be able to do the very difficult, I know very well from having tried an amateur way to do it, to be able to write science that does not cut corners, that doesn't compromise on accuracy and you know, on quality of presentation of the issues, that doesn't fudge the differences of opinion and disagreement, that, you know, that's solid and reliable. To be able to do that is not an easy thing. You need a deep understanding of science. Not something that the average clever, however clever they are, news desk writer can do just like that.